Desi, noun, a person of Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Nepali, or Sri Lankan origin who lives abroad.
American Desi. Well, that's what we hope to discover here.
Welcome to Indian American. I am Arjun.
And I'm Akash.
Today we are very thrilled. We have a very special guest. We have the esteemed Dr. Varun Soni. This is a man who graduated from Tufts, from Harvard Divinity School.
Boom.
And got his PhD at the University of Cape Town.
There you go.
In South Africa. This is a man who writes books.
That are being turned into movies.
And he edited a journal about Islamic and Near Eastern law.
Yeah, I don't know what that is, but I'm impressed.
Neither do I. But and he's now currently the Dean of Religious Life at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Soni.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored, and I feel like I should be interviewing you. You're both so accomplished, and
all right.
I look forward to the back and forth.
All right.
First off, I'd love to talk a little bit about what that means, the Dean of Religious Life.
So essentially what that means is that I oversee religious and spiritual life on our college campus at USC. Traditionally, that job was called the university chaplain. Some schools now call it a dean of religious life, but the responsibilities are basically the same. So what does that mean on a day-to-day basis? I oversee over 90 student groups on campus, which is more than any American campus. I oversee 50 chaplains of every faith tradition, which is the largest group of religious professionals on any American campus. We do pastoral care, spiritual counseling. We do major programs and events. We do a lot of interfaith engagement work and community service. So oversee all of the different aspects of religious and spiritual life on our university campus.
That is an all-encompassing job, yeah, right?
It's never
there.
A dull moment.
I want to ask you a couple questions about what is pastoral care? What does that
so
mean?
So pastoral care is when a student or a member of our university community is in crisis. They'll come speak to us in a confidential context. It's like you would sort of have with a cleric or a priest, et cetera. And so students may come to me or our associate dean, but we also have 50 chaplains on our staff. So the new model of religious life is they can come into our office and if they'd like, we can also connect them with people, not just from their faith tradition, but oftentimes from their denominational perspective. So not just that there's a rabbi on our staff, but there's an Orthodox rabbi, a conservative rabbi, a Reconstructionist rabbi, a Reform rabbi, et cetera.
So, and those 90 student groups that you mentioned, are those all religious-affiliated groups?
And we also oversee the atheist group, and we're about to welcome our first-ever humanist chaplain, essentially our first-ever atheist chaplain.
Amazing.
So I think what's unique about our office is most offices of religious life are oriented around God. But our office is oriented around meaning and purpose and authenticity, the things that make us human, the things that connect us with each other. So I feel we can be a resource for our entire university community because we're all looking for meaning and purpose and significance. And many people find that through God, but not everyone. So I think we have a very expansive view of what we mean when we mean religious and spiritual life. And part of that is the spiritual life part. You know, what does it mean to be spiritual but not religious? Many students talk about the fact that they're more spiritual than religious, and we really want to challenge them in terms of what does that mean for them as a person and what does that mean for their career aspirations.
Amazing. That sounds really holistic. I mean, there's something really like safe about that. I think that's the first thing that comes to me is that it feels like a safer. I mean, sometimes God as a term and as a thing can be somewhat alien. There's so much, not baggage, but there's so many feelings that come with that, that.
It's true. It's totally true. And so we have people who are very traditionally religious, and I feel like we offer them the worship spaces, the chaplaincy resources, the funding they need in order to thrive on campus. But we also do that with folks who don't believe in God or who aren't religious but are still looking for meaning and purpose in their life.
Well, I'd like to actually, I'm glad that you bring up the spaces because we're sitting right now in a really wonderful room. It's the meditation.
This is the meditation room.
Can you tell us a little bit about this room in particular?
Yeah, so we have a number of different groups on our campus, Hindu and Buddhist, who have meditation as part of their weekly or daily practice. But we're also about to launch a university-wide mindfulness initiative, mm-hmm. Kind of like what Google has with their chief happiness officer. But I think what we can do is not only offer mindfulness training classes or meditation classes to our university community, but we can do research and we can do teaching. We can be a little more expansive and encompassing with our approach. So we're going to launch this fall, and we'll have meditation opportunities every day for people to drop in. Then we'll have more formal classes for them to take for free. But the real idea is that in this highly technologized social media world, our students are sometimes overwhelmed by the amount of information that's being thrown at them, and also by the pressure that they have in an academic environment. So I believe that mindfulness is a way for us to encourage our university community to be still and just take a moment for themselves.
But I selfishly have to ask a question about mindfulness, because that's something I practice. I learned through the Insight Meditation Center in New York and in LA as well. I've continued my practice that way. And I'm curious, do you find that to be different than Hindu meditation or Buddhist meditation? Do you see a difference there?
It's a good question. What I've seen happening, I got involved with meditation when I studied Buddhism. I lived in Bodh Gaya, which is a town in India where the Buddha was enlightened. I lived as a Buddhist monk, and I used to meditate under the tree in which he was enlightened. And so I wanted to meditate because I wanted to walk through walls and levitate, you know?
Right.
But since that time, over the past 20 years, meditation has become more secular in the sense that there's mind-body stress reduction or mindfulness-based stress reduction. NIH is funding all these studies about how mindfulness can help with chemotherapy or other types of health issues. Google has a whole mindfulness initiative. So I think what's happened with mindfulness is it's become secular in the sense that it's not looking at spiritual evolution as much as health outcomes. So this is the way Google pitches it, for example, and this is what we're talking about at USC. If you are mindful, then you're more likely to be innovative and creative. You're more likely to have workplace happiness. That means the healthcare costs of the organization go down. So even though my own approach to mindfulness and meditation has been spiritual, I understand that if we're going to launch something on a secular university campus, we also should sort of tap into the secularization that's happened with mindfulness, where people talk about it from a health-based perspective as opposed to a spiritual perspective. I still think Hindu meditation is really a more spiritual or religious endeavor. I feel like Hindu meditation is often focused more on the heart and on the divine light. Mindfulness meditation can be more focused on the mind and clearing of the mind. You can be of any faith tradition or no faith tradition at all and still find value in a mindfulness experience. I think Hindu meditation is probably more valuable for people who are Hindu or people who believe in God.
I see. I want to ask you, aside from the actual things that you're doing, I want to ask you a little bit about yourself and how you came to be in this position. Right before we started interviewing, you told me something I hadn't even thought of in this perspective, but is it correct, you are the first Hindu chaplain? I mean, is that how you would say it?
So I'm the first Hindu in American history to be the chief religious or spiritual leader of a university. So other schools have Hindu chaplains, and we also have Hindu chaplains, but I am the university chaplain. I oversee all religious life, not just Hindu religious life, but all religious life. And so that's never happened before. All my colleagues around the country are ordained Protestant ministers. Wow. I'm a non-ordained Hindu attorney, so it's a very different model. USC really kind of thought outside the box. And because of that, I think we can have a different approach to religious life. I'm interested in what the future of religious life looks like, not what the past looked like. So that's what we're trying to model here. This is what I think the future looks like. It's religious and spiritual life. It's mindfulness. It's creativity and innovation in terms of faith-based practices. It's community service. It's interfaith engagement. So we really focus a lot on that.
Now, I have to ask you, so do you consider yourself a practicing Hindu?
I do, yeah.
Okay, and so this is something I might be wrong, but from what I understand, Hinduism is a dynamic religion.
Yep.
It goes for change. So do you think that helped in terms of the way you see things and the way right now you're saying, I'm always looking toward the future, I'm looking to where things are changing? Do you think being Hindu helps you there?
I absolutely think it helps me. I you know, especially the way I was raised, we all have a, you know, Hinduism is expansive. There are many different ways to be Hindu. It's a decentralized tradition. People have different interpretations of it, and that's built within the tradition itself. The way I was raised was in a very pluralistic way, that there are many paths up the mountain, but they're all going the same place.
Right.
And we're different strokes for different folks, but we're all on the same journey. You know, and that's what the Rig Veda says. Truth is one, but the wise call truth by many names. Or God is one, but the wise call God by many names. So if you have that perspective, it's easy for me to sort of work with different religious groups and not feel judgmental or threatened in any way. So I actually think that being a Hindu has been a huge asset in this role.
I grew up in Clearwater, Florida, and I remember being on the beach, and I had some friends that were Seventh-day Adventist, and there was a youth pastor of theirs that happened to be on the beach, and he invited me to their Sunday worship, like some Sunday service, and I said, I appreciate that, but I'm okay. And he said, I said, I don't go to church. And he said, no, it's okay. You don't have to go to church to come here. And I said, I'm just not Christian. And then he went and, his reaction was such, it was of a little bit of like, he stepped back. And I had been in an orchestra with a lot of people who are homeschooled and Baptist and had often, told me I was going to hell because I didn't believe in Jesus. These were like verbatim things that I heard. But I'm interested, this pastor though. Then I brought up that idea because I also subscribe to that idea that there were many paths to the mountain. We're all on different paths.
Yep.
So I said that to him, almost literally those words. And he said, I think it's a ladder. And I'm wondering, because there is that idea in a lot of Christian and a lot of faiths have that idea that their way is the path.
Yep.
Now, when you were saying that you're working, I don't know how much you work with these other chaplains or other heads of religious life that you in the country, but do you ever see a slight resistance or a slight sort of interaction in that between these people that feel a certain way about their faith?
Yes, there's no doubt. We have a very active interfaith council, but those are students who in some ways have already drunk the Kool-Aid, for lack of a better analogy. They already have bought into the concept that learning about other faiths edifies or strengthens their own, but not everyone feels that way. I think part of religious pluralism is to allow people the ability not to be pluralistic or not to engage in an interfaith way. So we provide opportunities for interfaith engagement. That doesn't mean that everyone avails themselves of those opportunities, but those opportunities are there if they want those opportunities. So I'm a Hindu and I oversee more evangelical Christian groups than anyone in the United States. That's a unique situation to be in.
Right.
I feel like I have very strong relationships with our evangelical leaders, even if they're less interested maybe in interfaith work as some of the other groups are might be interested in interfaith work. I still do my very best to support them wherever they're at. And I've really enjoyed that experience.
When you became the dean, was that, were you the associate dean or what was your path?
No, I was actually, I have a very unusual path to being the dean of religious life here. So I've done a lot of different things in my life. I was a professor at UCSB before I was a dean here, but I was teaching in the Law and Society department. I'm an attorney, entrepreneur. I had a radio show for a while. I started, a graphic novel company. And so I have a lot of diverse interests. And
you are putting us to shame. Right?
I was very much the out-of-the-box candidate. And to USC's credit, I think were looking for something different, and I represented that something different. I still spent my whole life really thinking about religion. Not that out of the box, in the sense that I had no background.
You lived under a tree.
I lived as a Buddhist monk. I have a PhD in religion. I have a master's in religion. I taught religion at the university level. I really think my path was kind of inspired by my grandfather. I grew up in a extended family, so my grandfather, my parents were physicians. They were working all the time. My grandfather really raised me.
Where were you born? Where were you?
I was born in Kanpur, but my parents were already living in New York at the time.
Stop it.
Yeah.
My whole mother's side of the family is from Kanpur.
Oh yeah.
834x38 Tilak Nagar.
Okay, what's the last name?
Rastogi.
Okay, well my mother's side are Khanas. I'm sure
That's amazing. That's some offline related conversation for y'all. Exactly. You get a little tease to what's going to happen post podcast.
Exactly. We're going to throw it down Kanpur stuff. But my grandfather had a very interesting background. His mother was very close with Kasturba Gandhi, and so she would go to jail with Kasturba, who was Mahatma Gandhi's wife. And so my grandfather as a kid grew up around the leaders of the Indian nationalist movement. So he used to regale me with these stories about Nehru and Gandhi, about these guys who were lawyers, but who also brought together spirituality and social justice, who thought about spiritual liberation and political liberation, right? And so these were the guys I was raised with, right. Gandhi, right. King, the Dalai Lama. And that's sort of how I saw my own career. That's why I went to law school, and that's why I studied religion. So even though I never thought I could be in a position like this, because no Hindu ever had been, I just figured no Hindu would be, because generally you have to be an ordained Protestant minister to have a position like this. When I got this job, I realized it's the job I always wanted. And a lot of my colleagues who are ordained Protestant ministers felt the same way. They never aspired to be a university chaplain or a dean of religious life. But when they got the job, they were like, this is what I was always looking for. And now I know it exists. But there's not a whole lot of jobs like it. So I don't think a lot of people have it on their radar.
Now, you didn't work for USC before?
No, I was at UC Santa Barbara. They brought me in.
And what were you doing immediately before? I know you had a ton of jobs.
I was teaching in the Law and Society Department at UC Santa Barbara. I had undergraduate classes. Okay. And then I was running these two companies. One was an immigration law company that was based out of Delhi. And one was this graphic novel company that we released our first graphic novel in 2012.
When did you come? So you were born and raised in Kanpur?
No, I was born in Kanpur, and I moved here when I was 6 weeks old.
Oh,
so
wow.
my parents were already living in the U.S. They were physicians doing their residency in New York, and my mother wanted to have me with her family around to support her.
Right.
So she went back really for the delivery, and I came back when I was 6 weeks old. So
wow.
I'm basically ABCD, even though I was technically born in Kanpur.
Right.
For those of our audience that don't know, ABCD is American born and confused Desi.
Yeah.
We won't explain Desi. You're supposed to know that already. Welcome to
If you're listening to the podcast, you probably know that.
If you don't know, that means you're a fob.
The great Desi fob, the great ABCD fob.
Now, let me ask you this. You said you're the only Hindu in this position.
Yeah,
you're the only non-Christian in this position.
Only non-Christian.
And we were talking earlier about many passes of the mountaintop versus the ladder.
Yeah.
Do you, amongst your colleagues, ever experience that kind of ladder mentality?
No. Because I think to do this job, you have to be a pretty liberal person. So
fair enough.
All my colleagues are super progressive Protestant ministers interested in social justice. They were all thrilled with my appointment. I've got nothing but support for them. They all are advocates for other people being in this position. Hopefully we'll see a Muslim or a Sikh or a Buddhist one day in a position like this as well.
Now, you think that could lead to a larger kind of shift in the way we view things? Because these are people in very powerful positions in universities across America that will influence a ton of students.
Yeah.
So in a larger sense, you think we could see a shift in ideals toward more unity and things like that?
I think it's coming from the bottom up. I think it's a generational thing. So I think I'm more of the result of a process rather than the instigator of a process. So in other words, we're at a very interesting time in American religious history.
Okay.
In 1950, 2% of Americans were not affiliated with any religious tradition. Today, 20% of Americans are not affiliated with any religious tradition.
Whoa.
It's the largest growing group in the United States of religious practitioners are those who are not affiliated. And amongst people in this country under 35, so our university students, that's 35% of them are not affiliated with any religious tradition. So what does that mean? It means that we are moving, I think, away from religious institutions and towards religious individuals. So our students still may believe in God, but they've lost faith in organized religion.
Right.
So to have someone like me who happens to be Hindu or happens to be an attorney or happens to have a different approach, maybe a little younger, I think that actually gives me legitimacy as opposed to not giving me legitimacy. I think the fact that I'm not ordained actually gives me a certain type of legitimacy amongst a population of students who are very suspicious of folks who are clerics because of the negative experiences they've seen with religion. They may have seen organized religion covering up child abuse or how they treat LGBT folks or supporting patriarchal structures, et cetera, and our students really aren't down with that. So I believe that, for our students, me being a Hindu wasn't really a big deal at all. And when I was appointed, there were some angry folks who wrote in to the university.
Really?
And I saw those letters, and most of them kind of were focused around the idea of,
Were those students' parents? Who were those
Probably
people coming
people.
From?
So they're all alums.
Okay.
But and they're all talking about, we're a Judeo-Christian institution and country. How can you have a Hindu or an idolater, polytheist, leading our students? That being said, I noticed that every single letter was written by an alum who graduated before 1980.
Right.
Wow.
So that is a generational shift. There was not a single student who said he's not appropriate because he's Hindu. Now, maybe a student will say, you're not doing your job right, or you should be doing X, Y, or Z differently. Maybe students will have these legitimate complaints, but it won't be based on the fact that I'm a Hindu.
Right.
So I think that we see that even today, that for a certain generation of the American population, for me being a Hindu was kind of a big deal or even something that's distressful. But for our current university students, I don't even think it was on the radar.
Not.
It was
Well, that brings me to another a curiosity I have about tolerance, religious tolerance. You are a position that you have an understanding of the religious state, kind of state of affairs in this in the country to some degree, at least better than I do, for sure. So I'm curious, as where do you think religious tolerance is? Is it kind of just what you're just saying, is that things are really changing, where people are more tolerant towards people's ideas and thoughts? It's actually more of an anger towards institutions?
Yes, I think that things are changing, like I said, on a generational level. I think young folks who go to college especially and meet and know people of different faiths don't have the same fear of faiths that they may have inherited from their parents. You know, 1/3 of all marriages in the United States today are interfaith marriages. They happen between faiths. Hmm. And actually that number is 1/2 at the beginning, and then people will convert to the tradition of their partner or spouse. So it comes down to 1/3 at the end. So 1/3 of new marriages are interfaith marriages. That means our students who come to USC, it's not, they don't just know Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists. They may be related to Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists. Right. When I went to college in 1992, I may have been the first Hindu that anyone had ever met.
Right.
I had to carry this great mantle of a 5,000-year-old spiritual tradition wherever I went. In a way, that challenged me to think more about my faith. And when you're a religious minority, I think you have to know more about your religion so you can answer questions. No one asked the Hindu in a Hindu temple in India, what are you doing?
Right.
But people ask the Hindu in the United States, what do you believe, right? So in a way, we have to be representatives of our faith and know more than maybe our cousins would even know in India. But it's also it's not a fair burden to place on someone to have to carry that kind of mantle. So I don't think our students have to carry that mantle as much anymore because they know people of different faiths. The millennial generation, I call them the post-thriller generation because they're born after Michael Jackson. You know, for most scholars of religion, it's like before and after Christ. For me, it's before and after Thriller. You know? So they grew up in this post-thriller world, and they're 80 million strong, and it's the most multicultural, multi-faith generation in human history. So I do think the change is bottom up. It's generational. I do think there is a movement away from religious organizations and institutions towards personal experience. And that might be a shift from religion to spirituality. 2/3 of college students say they're more spiritual than religious.
I've always never really understood what that
meant. Yeah, what does that mean? That's
a good question. It feels like, from my own journey, it was just a way of appreciating some divinity in the world without really... You know, in some ways for me, there was a laziness attached to it.
Yeah.
I have to be totally honest with you, until I've solidified them in certain ways. But I'm curious when you're saying it, what do you mean?
I think you're right. There can be a laziness attached to it because it doesn't encourage anyone to go beyond that statement. I'm spiritual, but not religious. And that's it.
Exactly.
And what does that really mean? But I think there are genuine spiritual seekers who are millennials. I see this in our interfaith council, people who identify as like trans spiritual. I'm like, I don't know what that means, but I want to be trans spiritual. I think for those folks, spirituality means it's a personal as opposed to an organizational search for meaning or truth or identity. Right. Deepak Chopra said, and I like this, he says, religion is someone else's experiences and spirituality is your own experience.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, religion is what we read about, other people's prophets, messiahs, avatars, etc. But spirituality is what we experience
deal with on a day-to-day
in our life.
Right.
A computer engineer said to me, religion is closed source and spirituality is open source. So I think there's different kinds of articulations of what spirituality means. But I think for the most part, it just means that people, it goes hand in hand with the rise of the non-affiliated. If you're disaffiliating from organized religion, you're probably more likely to call yourself spiritual as opposed to religious. And so 20% of Americans are disaffiliated from organized religion, but only 2% are atheist, right? So there's still 18% who believe in God, who have some yearning for some kind of spiritual nourishment. They're just not finding that through traditional religion. And I think those are the people that would call themselves spiritual as opposed to religious.
I got to ask you this about, just what you're saying about these non-affiliated.
Yeah.
And you're talking about that. One thing that's really an important, you know, purpose for the organization of religions is the passing on of those knowledge.
Yeah.
So if these people are disavowing themselves from these organizations, where are they getting their knowledge from?
It's a really important question. It's the question that a lot of churches are asking themselves, churches that are mainline Protestant churches that have congregations that are mostly in their 60s and 70s.
Right.
So where are they getting it from? I think they're getting it from other people, from the internet, from their own experiences. We run field trips to different houses of worship, and lots of students will just go, even if they're not affiliated with any religion, to see what a sick lunger is like, or see what the call to prayer is like, et cetera. So just because they don't want religion in their own life, that doesn't mean they're not religiously literate. They actually are religiously literate. They've just decided that there's nothing that makes a lot of sense for them. And I think what you see going on is less depth, more breadth. Now, traditional religious scholars talk about this, and leaders lament this, as a watering down of one's tradition, which I understand, because students may know less about their own faith and more about other people's faiths. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. And where it goes, we'll see. But there's no doubt that this is a significant moment in American religious history, that two-thirds of American divinity schools are on the verge of shutting down because there's no enrollment, that many mainline Protestant churches call themselves cadaver churches because they're elderly churches. I mean, I go to churches, synagogues, mosques. Most people will ask me, where are young people? And I think a lot of people assume that young people will go to college, walk away from their faith, and when they have kids, they'll come back to their faith. They may come back to their faith, but it may not look the way their parents' faith looks. I think what you lose in all this, more than anything, is a sense of community. And my concern is that in an age of social media, where people have virtual communities, they'll think that that is enough. And my concern is that our students who may have 1,000 friends on Facebook may not have real friends, like 2 or 3 friends who have their back. That our students who are so busy talking with their thumbs aren't able to articulate with their tongues what is on their mind, you know? And so I think that if a virtual community replaces that traditional community, and I think religion is really about community, we're all going to be impoverished because of that. And I think people will either have to find other types of communities, like I'm part of a fanboy community or I'm part of a sports community, and I'll throw myself into that community with the same zeal that my parents threw themselves into a religious community. I think that's one outcome. And I think the other outcome is that religious leaders aren't going to be clerics or imams or what have you. I mean, who is the religious leader of the United States? I would argue the religious leader of the United States, or the spiritual leader of the United States, is Oprah Winfrey.
That's what I was honestly going to say. Oprah.
Because what is Oprah talking about? She's talking about the things that traditional religious clerics have talked about. She's talking about justice and compassion and empathy and opening your mind and healing yourself. But because she's not from a denominational perspective and because she's not ordained, she can talk to a much larger group of people than she could if she was a traditional religious figure. So I think that's the new model. I think that we're going to have people who aren't traditionally trained in religion who have become spiritual leaders, in the same way that Tim Tebow can draw 20,000 people to church, his pastor can probably draw 500 people to church. Right. His pastor has the theological training.
Yeah, but he can't throw a football. Yeah,
well,
but
neither can Tim Tebow, apparently.
But isn't there a concern maybe this isn't a concern, maybe this is a concern that's just for me, but there's the Rig Vedas and the Upanishads and even the Gita, there's a lot of complex language, and just open sourcely throwing that on the internet and me reading that without guide, without a mentor, without that sort of aspect, it can be difficult.
And in the Indian tradition, it's almost impossible. That's why you need a guru.
You need
a guru in the Hindu tradition. Otherwise, you know, just like the football player needs a coach, you need a spiritual coach. So yeah, that's built within the tradition. I agree that it's difficult to do it in the absence of traditional religious clerics, but look at our peers. How many of them are studying religion? I'm the only one I knew that's studying religion. I come from a family of physicians. I was the black sheep. I was super, you know, I was totally discouraged at every turn from doing this. All the uncles and aunties were always like, Beta, what are you doing? Why are you throwing your life away? Right. And then when I became a dean, they were like, oh, we always believed in you. You're so brilliant. I'm like, auntie, you were talking smack about me last week. I'm the same dude, you know. I know it. So, but there's no one else. I don't have a whole lot of South Asian peers who are studying religion. So there is no next generation. Where's the next generation of Hindu American leadership? I don't know where it is, you know. Who are the Hindu-American leaders in our country today? I mean, there's Deepak Chopra. There's Apu from The Simpsons. There's not a whole lot out there. Right. So I don't know what that generation of Hindu-Americans who are growing up today are going to learn about their faith. I think they're going to do it through universities. And what I tell, we just established the first ever community chair of Hindu studies at USC a few years ago. We're going to the community and we're raising $3 million to establish a chair in the name of Swami Vivekananda. And
I tried to read that book, by the way. I have never found anything more dense in my life. Nothing has ever gone over my head so fast.
As much as Vivekananda.
Yeah.
But what I tell people is that your kids are not going to learn about Hinduism in temples. The Hindu community spent $1 billion on temples. They're spent. They're building out. We're building a $100 million temple in New Jersey, the biggest Hindu temple in the world.
I know. Right.
But our students aren't going to learn about Hinduism in the temple. They're going to learn about Hinduism in the classroom, and that's why the new temples, I think, are these endowed chairs and research centers at universities.
Well, let me ask you a question. I just thought of this as you brought up aunties and uncles wanting us to enter certain fields.
Yeah.
There's a ton of academic pressure placed upon kids.
Yeah.
I think almost at the expense of learning about your religion and learning about your culture. Do you think that negatively impacts how Hindus are going to, like second-generation Indians, first-generation Indians, are going to approach Hinduism?
I think so. I think there's something hypocritical about our community, whereby when I was growing up, every auntie and uncle were saying, why don't you learn more about your religion and your faith, and you're a Hindu and you should know about it, and you should be taking Hindi classes and Sitar classes and go to India. And the second I decided to make that my profession, they're like, no, what are you doing?
Right,
we
right.
moved to the U.S., so you wouldn't have to do right. that. You should be a physician or an engineer, or even right. a lawyer was controversial at the time when I went to law school. So I think that's, and it, this is the irony of the whole thing is that when I'm talking to people who are giving money from to the chair, I say to them, it's great that you're giving money to the chair, but you should also let your children encourage your children to take classes that you have funded through this chair, because the same folks who are giving money would often discourage their own children from going into religion as a field. They believe in it enough to fundraise for it, but not enough for their children to go in it. And partly because there's no path, right? And our immigrant parents are worried about how their children are going to make money.
Security.
Exactly.
What are you going to do with a PhD in religion? Or what are you going to do as a Hindu studies
financial
scholar?
Financial security is big.
It's a big deal. And I know that. So I understand that the immigrant mindset is really looking for security and stability and status. But that's what our parents as immigrants were looking for. I think what we're looking for is meaning and purpose and identity and significance in our personal and professional lives. I mean, you're a comedian, you're an actor, I'm an academic. Those are three non-traditional Desi occupations for people of our generation.
Yeah, we all fucking up.
but I think it's because we were motivated by something other than status, security, et cetera. We
Absolutely.
Were motivated by right. passion, inspiration, mm-hmm. love, meaning, identity, et cetera. So I think, you know, and that's why I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to speak with you. You guys are creating a model where other Desi kids can then become comics and actors. Because if one Indian is successful at it, then parents generally are much better at letting their children do it. Thank God for Cal Penn and Jhumpa Lahiri and, you know, Bobby Jindal, because they opened up the doors.
I don't know about that one. I'm not going to lie.
Well,
I don't know
Bobby
how
Jindal.
Much I want to thank you for Bobby Jindal, but you're a better person than I am. So
well, listen, I disagree with him on probably everything politically, but he now
his name.
Yes, we'll call him Piyush. Okay.
Right.
But now, at least the Indian kid who wants to be a politician can
True.
Say, look at Bobby
True.
Jindal, look at Nikki Haley,
right.
look at some of these other folks. There is a path. And their parents can say, yeah, there is a path, you know?
I mean, that's it really brings us to an interesting segue, because we did want to ask about Hindu studies and the kind of people that are entering that class. Because I didn't grow up with a lot of knowledge on Hinduism.
Yeah.
I have to be honest. It's interesting because, you know, Hinduism is as much a culture as it is a religion.
Yeah.
One of the biggest fights I had with my parents
yeah.
was when I told them that I didn't feel like they raised me Hindu. Oh
yeah.
my God.
Yeah.
The utter
yeah.
wrath that,
yeah.
what do you mean?
Yeah.
My dad, I mean, my mom, who's usually the very peaceful person, like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And I was like, no, you guys aren't understanding what I mean. Because I had separated them culturally
yeah.
and religiously. I wonder if you could first talk about that.
Yeah.
The Can they be separated? Are they separate?
I think in India, they're not separate. I think Indianism and Hinduism kind of overlap. The cultural aspects, the theological aspects overlap. Most people who are Hindus will say Hinduism is not a religion. It's a way of life, or it's a science of thinking. I think there's some truth to that historically. The whole concept of religion as this bounded, organized entity is really a Western conception.
Mm-hmm.
Even the idea of Hinduism as a world religion is in some ways a British colonial construction. So
what do you mean by that?
Well, I say Hinduism is both the oldest and the newest world religion. It's the oldest because its roots go back to the Vedas, right?
Yeah.
And the Rig Veda is the oldest sacred text in the world. We can't even date it because it's an oral tradition,
right.
but it's at
right.
least several thousand years older than the monotheistic Western texts, the Abrahamic texts. It's the newest religion in the world because Hindus never thought of themselves as part of this religion called Hinduism up until I think fairly recently. Instead, they were on different paths. I am a follower of Shiva. I'm a follower of Buddha. I'm a follower of Kali. I'm a follower of Vishnu, etc., Krishna devotee. So you had different paths and different devotees. But when the British came to India and they were doing all their surveying to see who they were ruling, they wanted to take censuses of who was in their different regions. And so they said, well, this is Muslims. These are Christians. These are Sikhs. These are, you know, Buddhists or Jains, and everyone else is a Hindu. So it became kind of a definition that was given to a people, rather than one that was inherited or the people came up with themselves. Now, Hindus have appropriated the term Hinduism in a way that makes sense for them, but it's almost like saying Native American religion. The, you know, in the West, we say, oh, Native American religion, as if it's a singular thing.
Right.
But
right.
The reality is that there's nothing that connects the Hopi and the Pequot and the Chumash and the Lakota, except for the fact that they're all geographically in the same place, the Americas. But they have different origin stories, different canons, different rituals, different languages, different deities. So we should be saying Native American religions in the same way with Hinduism. Hinduism is a decentralized religion. It has no founder. It has no common book. It has no common god. It has no common language, no common ritual, no common creed.
You wouldn't say that the Gita has become some
it's
sort
become
of...
It's become that.
Right.
It's okay. become that. And that's the Hindu, post-colonial Hindu sort of reconstruction of Hinduism and appropriation of Hinduism. But it wasn't always that. That was a sort of Sanskritic text that was part of a larger epic, the Mahabharata, that... You know,
that's what
only
I always
2%
used to
of the population could even read. So right. to think that this was a representative text for all Hindus, it wasn't.
Right.
It's become that, but it wasn't always that way. So, and even within our epic traditions, like the Ramayana, how many different Ramayans we have in India? So you can't even say that there's one. You know, there's the North Indian version, there's a South Indian
right,
version. There's
yeah.
a version where Ravan is the hero.
Right.
And people say, you know, Ramayana can just be like this Aryan kind of fantasy tale about Dravidian, you know, conquering Dravidians. And so it's actually a tale of oppression and not liberation. So these texts are contested. They have multiple interpretations. To say that there's a centralized creed or what have you, historically, it just isn't true. That being said, listen, Hindus are oriented around certain themes like dharma. Dharma is at the heart of Hinduism, and all Hindus have their own conception of dharma. But dharma itself doesn't even translate as religion. You can't even translate the word dharma into English.
Could you take a second, just in case we have some non-Hindu
yes.
and non-Indian speakers,
yeah.
and just kind of lightly
talk about dharma? So dharma is like the Indian concept, I think. This is my interpretation. That's why, just like we call Judaism, Christianity, and Islam the Abrahamic traditions, many people call the uniquely Indian religions, the ones that were born in India or the South Asian subcontinent, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and Sikhism. Those are the Dharma traditions because they're all oriented around this concept of Dharma. So Dharma is something that is at the root of what it means to be Indian, but we can't really translate it into English. It might mean law or religion or the path or the way. I think of Dharma as some kind of ethic of righteousness or
right.
ethical conduct, but there are many meanings of dharma. And so because of that, I think, because Hinduism is a fairly decentralized religion, it's hard for Westerners to wrap their mind around it. I mean, Hinduism is the third largest religion in the world. We have over a billion Hindus in the world, but it's still hard for a Westerner to articulate what Hinduism means because it's hard for anyone to articulate what Hinduism
right.
means because it's a decentralized religion. I think it's hard for us. We're the first generation of Hindu Americans, us, you know. We were
right.
raised after the 1965 Immigration Naturalization
right.
Act. That opened the door for Hindu Americans. Before that, there were some Indians. There were mostly Sikh Punjabis. We are the first generation to be born and raised Hindu in the United States. And it was difficult for me, and I'm sure difficult for you, to articulate what Hinduism was.
It's still difficult for me.
To people who
levels.
Ask. Yeah. And it's partly because it's a decentralized tradition.
Well, that brings me to an interesting question, or a question I found interesting, is people who enter classes or who don't know anything about Hinduism, they probably have a lot of preconceived notions.
Yeah.
Have
it's
you noticed?
Cow curry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And statues.
Yeah.
So after they leave like religion classes where they learn about Hinduism in your experience or maybe even just work with you, how do those preconceived notions change?
I think there's two types of students in those classes. There's just your average sort of American, not average American, but you know your American student, not of Indian descent. You're
right.
just
non-Indian.
any non-Indian student on
right.
our
right.
campus who, and those are actually the majority of people in classes on Hinduism, who are just interested in learning about Hinduism or who are religion majors or who are doing a GE or whatever.
Right.
I think they come to the class with certain stereotypes. Those stereotypes are quickly deconstructed.
Right.
I think it's harder for the Hindu to come to a class with other ideas of Hinduism from his or her own, personal experience, what their parents might have taught them or what they learned in their village when they went back to India, that doesn't jive with what they're being taught. So I think they have a harder time thinking about Hinduism in a more expansive way than the way they were raised. But if they go through that process, I think they come to Hinduism in a much more appreciative way because they've been critical. And that's, I think, the difference between being raised Hindu and studying Hinduism. When you're raised Hindu, you're taught about all the great things about Hinduism. But when you study Hinduism in classroom, you take a critical approach. So we can talk about some of the issues in Hinduism. We can talk about, you know, gender disparity issues or caste oppression issues in a way that is historically grounded, scripturally grounded, theoretically interesting, et cetera. And you would never have that just as a Hindu being raised in the U.S. It's all about why Hinduism is good for you. But you don't think about it from like you might think about economics or political science. You don't take the same critical approach. And that's why I think university classrooms can offer something that temples can't.
What were some of the things you struggled with when you studied Hinduism from an academic standpoint, that going from Hinduism is great to, oh, here's some things that aren't great about Hinduism?
Yeah, that's good. I think part of it is partly my own challenge was to reconcile my Buddhist and Hindu beliefs because I was raised, my grandfather is Buddhist, but my family is Hindu, and I have family that are sick. And so I it's kind of like the Parliament of the World Religions at dinner. But but for me, it was, can I be Hindu and can I be Buddhist at the same time? Can I, you know, because I consider my guru to be His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. So I have a Buddhist guru, but I call him a guru like I would a Hindu teacher. And my understanding now is, yes, I can be, because these ideas of Buddhism and Hinduism as these bounded entities, like I said, are in some ways Western ideas. From an Indian perspective, these are traditions that have always been in conversation with each other, that have always been in debate with each other. Hindus go to Buddhist shrines in India, and Buddhists go to Hindu temples in India. And the Dalai Lama talks a lot about texts that Hindus also talk a lot about. And the idea of Dharma is at the root of both Buddhism and Hinduism. And, you know, for Hindus, Buddha was an avatar of Vishnu. And so...
Well, I was just at Angkor Wat.
Yeah.
And actually, I didn't know this one. I had been told that they were just a collection of Buddhist temples. I didn't realize that a lot of them were actually Hindu.
You see the Ramayana all over the place.
And Vishnu is everywhere. And then they kind of reappropriated or Buddhism was added on top of it. So it's really... I'd not thought about the conversation like...
You know, in India, it's messy. You know, everything goes in and sort of mixes, and you can't create these theoretical boundaries in India because people worship in different houses of worship. And, you know, we always talk about all the contentious history of religious traditions in India, but there's this amazing history in India of shared sacred space, of shared songs and rituals and deities. You look at, for example, devotional music of Punjab. You look at Sufi Qawwali, Sikh Kirtan, and Hindu Bhajan. They're singing the same songs, you know. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan is singing songs about Rama. And, you know, in the Sikh Guru Granth Sahib, the Sikh Bible, if you will, the holiest text is just is a text of poetry set to music. It's the only sacred text like that in the world. And it contains poetry by poets we now consider to be Hindu and Muslim. And that's in this Guru Granth Sahib.
Wow.
So, you know, there's fluid, syncretic religious exchanges happening historically across South Asia. To me, that's really interesting. It's the counter narrative to the idea that religion is inherently a source of conflict. And I don't think that's the case in India.
Right.
Yeah. It can be, but it's not inherently a source of conflict.
That's so deep. That's like literally messing with my mind right now because it is so true. I mean, especially in this country and especially with, you know, the Crusades and these kind of things, we're taught, and especially with the way, I mean, especially in light of what's happening in the Middle East right now and in Israel, we do see religion as such this dividing and source of conflict. So hearing what you're saying like that is an incredibly and profound way of it gives hope to moving forward that if we can get back to that idea, that maybe there's hope.
And what I am really sort of inspired by is this generation of kids, man, these college kids who are under 30 years old now, they're the ones who are more likely to take us to that place than, you know, our parents or grandparents.
Why do you say that?
Because they're less caught up in these strict ideas of religious boundaries, in fearing the other. They're more integrated. They're more, they're comfortable with diversity. They're not threatened by each other. They're focused on spirituality. They're proactive. They come up with their own terms, you know. like I said, trans-spiritual, or right. I'm Zen Christian, or I'm sushi. I'm like, what is sushi? Oh, my father is Sunni and my mother is Shia. I'm sushi. So like they take, wow. they're very comfortable with hybridized and new identities that they're even creating themselves. You know, the leader of our interfaith council last year belonged to the Church of the Jedi, and she was very serious about the Jedi is my church. And,
I'm sorry, you're like Jedi from Star Wars.
Yeah.
Is there a church, or is that something she created for her?
No, go online. There's a Church of the Jedi.
As the dean of this like interfaith stuff, do you have to take that? Like, do you have to pretend you take that seriously?
I take it seriously, man. I totally take it seriously. Evil. Okay. I totally take it seriously.
That's a good answer. I like the way you do your job.
Especially on this campus where, I mean, check this out. This woman, she's an amazing woman. She gave our baccalaureate speech and talked about the fact that she was part of the Church of the Jedi. That's like almost like the commencement speech, but for religious and spiritual life. And, after she gave the speech, the dean of the Cinematic Arts School sent it to George Lucas, who founded built this new cinematic art school. And Mark Hamill's wife and daughter were in the audience because Mark, they are also USC students, and they went up to her and embraced her. I was like, only at USC could you give a speech about the Church of the Jedi, and you have Luke Skywalker's family in the audience, and George Lucas reading the speech, and it's, you know, and in many ways, USC is sacred space in the Star Wars universe.
It's the next Scientology.
I want to go back to you were talking about class.
Yes.
And you were saying that most students happen to be non-Indians. I would like to talk about those Indians that come in there. Yeah. Could you speak on the reasons that they're coming to class?
Yeah.
And you had spoken a little bit earlier about the discouragement that they feel from family.
So I don't think they're discouraged from taking those classes. I think they're discouraged from becoming religion majors or pursuing religion as graduate students or pursuing religion as a vocation, but not necessarily taking those classes. I think their parents are happy probably that they're taking one or two introductory classes. I think they come to those classes as heritage students like you like we were discussing. We were raised in this country wondering, are we Indian or American? Mm-hmm. I felt very Indian when I was in the U.S. growing up. And then when I went to visit my family in India, I felt very American. And I didn't feel like I belonged in either place.
Right.
I feel like our students feel like they belong in both places, but they're still reconciling what it means to be Hindu because their challenge is our challenge. How do you define a decentralized tradition? So they come really out of personal curiosity to learn more about themselves. And that's I had no real intention to be a professional religious person until I took that first religion class and had an amazing professor, and he turned me on to a different way of seeing the world. So I went in kind of just with the same idea that many of our students go in with, which is learning more about myself, my own tradition. Because think about it, when you are raised Hindu, you may go to temple, you may celebrate Rakhi and Diwali and some of the other stuff. You may be culturally Hindu, but you might not know what it means theologically to be Hindu. And I had the same experience with a lot of my Jewish American friends. They were culturally Jewish, but not until we got to college could they study Judaism and could I study Hinduism from a theological or scriptural perspective. Not until I got to college did I really start to understand what Hindu theology was. Did I really start to think about Atman or Brahman or what have you. I think that being in a university classroom gives them the ability to, for the first time in their life, and maybe the only time in their life, really study something from a theological, historical, scriptural, cultural perspective, as opposed to just the way their parents understand it, or their pundit understands it, or their grandparents understand it.
Are there resources for those of us who are out of, because I don't know if anyone else hearing this is,
but I'm going to ask you about books as soon as this is over.
I want to ask because there might be some other people that are inspired on that. Is there resources to kind of, how do we, outside of the college structure or outside of the classroom, kind of jump into that kind of study? Is there a way?
There are several degree programs that are going online now that study yoga or yoga philosophy or Vedanta. LMU has a master's in yoga philosophy program for yoga practitioners who want to learn about the philosophical aspects of it, not just the physical aspects of it. I think there's a lot of information online. There are a few good books out there too. The book that I read recently that I love, that I think goes to the essence of Hindu theology without actually ever using the word Hindu, but it's clear that that's what this person is explaining. And he explains it in a book in a way that I spent 20 years studying this, and I feel like he does that in like 200 pages, is called The Untethered Soul. And it was a New York Times bestseller several years ago. It is the best articulation, I think, of Hindu theology. So if people are interested in a theological perspective, I would check out The Untethered Soul.
We're writing that down.
We're writing that down because we don't trust the podcast either. We're writing that down. That's I want to ask about yoga. Yeah. As a slightly, I get furious about the way that yoga is practiced here in this country. I get furious about the way that it feels like it's an appropriation. I think it's to me yoga to separate yoga and Hinduism, which has been very successfully done in this country, is disrespectful.
Yeah,
and it's quite shocking to me oftentimes, and it's always put me in a kind of sad way for myself. It's put me at odds with something that is from my own culture.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could speak your thoughts on that, how you feel about it.
Yeah, it's a good question. There's been a lot of debate about this. Is yoga Hindu? You know, there was a court case in San Diego that just went through.
I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, so they were teaching yoga in a public school, and they were saying, well, if yoga is Hindu, then how can we teach Hinduism and yoga at a public school? Because isn't that a violation of church and state?
Right.
Not really.
So,
that's different.
I think the way mindfulness meditation has been secularized out of Buddhism is the same way yoga has been secularized out of Hinduism. And what I see with mindful meditation is there are a lot of people who would never do Buddhist meditation, but who benefit tremendously from a mindfulness practice. I think with yoga, it's probably something similar. There might not be a lot of people who would go to yoga if it was in an ashram with a Hindu guru, but if it's kind of packaged as, hey, come look hot and get your abs ripped, they're more likely to do it, right?
But then why call it yoga? It's not yoga. Mindfulness meditation isn't, and for the record, at least in mindfulness meditation, they throw kudos or they at least talk about where this stuff comes from.
Yeah.
And then Buddhist texts are encouraged and offered as, you know, guidance. In yoga,
they say namaste at the end.
They don't. First of all, they don't. They say namaste. Get that shit right, please. That's shocking to me. I mean, like, this is such a thing for me. It gets me so furious about this thing. So I don't know. I don't really see, even if it's a secular religion.
I think it's disingenuous to say that yoga is not part of Hinduism, and a lot of people say that. That being said, I have seen a lot of people in my own life, Westerners, who come to yoga, and they come to yoga as a health-based practice, but from their experience with yoga, they end up learning a lot about Hinduism. They become devotees, they go to India, they embrace Hindu ideas in a way that many Hindu Americans don't embrace them. So I do think that it can be a door to something bigger. As you know, Hatha yoga is just one of the eight limbs of yoga. So I find that some people who go to Hatha yoga will then learn about the other limbs of yoga, learn about Patanjali and read the Yoga Sutras and go to India and have a yoga practice that is also a spiritual practice. So I think it can do some good. I do roll my eyes, though, when I pass, like I live in Venice and every day I pass a studio and they're trying to be like the anti-yoga yoga. They're called yoga, but they call it the no om zone. It says no Sanskrit, no granola. No chanting, like somehow granola is an Indian thing apparently, or a Vedic thing. But the irony of it is that the people, even though the owner is pitching it as like this secular yoga practice that has no spiritual connection, the people who go there are saying namaste or namaste to each other. They're bowing to each other. They're drinking their own water bottles, et cetera, et cetera. So,
but you can't devoid. It's hard for me to devoid that spirituality from yoga because it's about literally taking time with yourself.
Yeah.
And experiencing breath. You know, I don't know. It's hard for me to even say that mindfulness meditation doesn't have Buddhas. Like, it's hard for me to see these things as secular at all, truthfully.
Yeah.
But that may just be my perspective on this. I don't know.
I agree that their roots are spiritual and based in India. I think that they've been secularized so they can be brought into a gym or brought into a Google in a way that doesn't seem like you're forcing religion on someone. I do think there are health-based benefits to both, but...
And I agree with that.
But there may also be spiritual benefits.
No, and I agree with both of that. I think my anger comes from like you're stealing something from my people and not giving them credit.
Yeah.
And like as if this hasn't originated from India and you aren't in some ways like taking and gaining so much from something that happened in.
I actually think, I'm sorry to interrupt this conversation, but I think people know that it came from Hinduism. And like he was saying, it's led people.
I think more people know it came from India.
And I think it's made Hinduism more acceptable to, like, if someone takes yoga, I don't know them to scoff at me for being Hindu.
Yeah.
Whereas 20 years ago, before yoga was really popping, if, you know, if I told somebody I was Hindu, they'd be like, what the fuck is that?
Right.
Now I think there's it's made Hinduism more acceptable.
And let's also, let's be honest about the Indian scene. You know, India, yoga has only become popular in India again because it was popular in the West.
Yeah.
It's like the pizza effect, right?
Right.
You know, in the 70s, you might have had a few ashrams in India,
right,
people doing yoga that were based in a particular tradition. But now you have yoga studios all over India, and it's really because of the rise of yoga in the West. So I don't even think Indians probably appreciated it historically as much as they do now. And it's because other people appreciate it. That's unfortunate.
No, that's some real shit, though. Yeah. That's some real shit.
Can I ask one more question before we go? This is, we did not mean to talk this long, but you've been honestly incredibly interesting, and I want to ask you one more question least. You talked about how we kind of lose a sense of community because of this online community that we all feel like we're a part of, younger kids.
Yeah.
What do you think, there's going to be a Hindu American community? If not, is it going to be one sort of spiritual community?
Yeah.
And if you, I mean, how do you plan on, like...
It's such a good question. I think the Hindu American community is not well organized at all in the United States. Obviously, when I go to interfaith events, there's always Buddhists and Muslims and Sikhs and, you know, Jews and Christians. I'm always the only Hindu. There's no other Hindu. I'm lonely. Like, I want to have other people sitting at the table with me. So people call me about the Hindu perspective on X, Y, or Z. I'm not even, you know, I'm not an authority on those issues, but they don't know who else to call in the public sphere. So this is what I think. I think that one of the reasons why Hindus aren't so well organized in the United States, and there's no Hindu American identity, so to speak, is in the same way that there's a Muslim American or Sikh American identity, is because we've had a pretty easy time in the United States. Let's be honest.
Right.
We, more than any religious minority, we have had the easiest time.
Right.
Look at how the Catholics and the Jews were treated in the United States when they came here. It was brutal, you know, how discriminated against they were. And even today, the number one hate crime in this country is anti-Semitism. So you just have to scratch the surface.
More so
than Islamophobia.
Really?
You just have to scratch the surface. Look at how Muslims have been treated, both in terms of government action and social attitudes after 9/11. Look at all the hate crimes that Sikh Americans have gone through. 900 hate crimes after 9/11. Look at what the Japanese Buddhists went through during internment, where 140,000 people were taken from their homes without due process and put in internment camps for years. No religious minority in the United States has had it as easy as Hindus. And that means that we haven't had to be organized. The reason why Sikhs and Muslims are so well organized, in part, is because they need to be organized because there are real issues and challenges of discrimination and even state action that they have to mobilize against. We haven't had to do that.
Right.
So when we come together, we're not sure what we're mobilizing for or against. And I also think that Hindu Americans, historically, our parents have been more interested in into assimilation as opposed to cultural preservation.
Yes.
Like, I was raised to be American. I wasn't raised to be Indian American. My parents wanted me to have an American experience, which was great, but I think we probably missed something there. So I think because we haven't had a history of discrimination in this country, we're not as well organized as we can be. Now, that doesn't mean we should wait for a major incident to start being organized.
I think
we can try and think of a different model where persecution isn't the orienting principle that brings us together, but the reality is that it's oftentimes that is what actually inspires or mobilizes.
You're one of the leading, you know, you're one of the, you know, at least in the public sphere, you've mentioned that you're the, who people come to from a Hindu American's perspective. You are in some ways the authority that we're coming to. What could be another kind of orienting idea? What can be the thing that brings us together, besides a sense of community?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that I come back to this notion of dharma, that we can think deeply about what dharma means in our life and how it translates into the work that we do. There are not going to be a lot of Hindu American leaders who have a background in religion, but the doctor can be the Hindu American leader. The engineer can be the Hindu American leader. Mm-hmm. You look at the Hindu American Foundation, everyone who's on that board has another job. They work for Kaiser, they're lawyers, they're this or that, but they're also coming together to do this kind of advocacy work. So I think we have to pioneer a model for what a Hindu American leader looks like outside of a religious context.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to my hope is that at some point our generation will articulate a progressive platform for what it means to be Hindu. And connect that to social action in some way, shape, or form. That's historically what we've seen in India, but we haven't quite seen that in the United States. So,
and we're kind of losing that in India too.
I think we're probably losing that in India. Although there are a lot of Hindu groups in India that do a lot of good work.
Yeah, of course.
So, let's see. Let's see what happens. You know, Hindu American Foundation has been trying to do this work with the way Hinduism is represented in textbooks or the way Hindus are treated in Pakistan or Bangladesh. So there are different kinds of approaches that they have, but those are more reactive towards something happening. I want to see a proactive kind of approach to what it means to be Hindu American. I'm not sure what that looks like, but I think we need a lot of people to start having that conversation to get to a point where we know what it looks like.
Well, guys, you see your call to arms. We need to start that conversation. So we're going to have to find another time to bring you back because there's so much to discuss.
Thank you so much.
Totally, this is great.
Thank you so much for joining us and letting us into your home.
Thank you.
We really, really appreciate it. Any other thoughts before we let you leave today?
No, I'm just really inspired by what you've been able to accomplish in your career. Really excited about this podcast. I think this is exactly the type of conversation that we need to have to start answering the very questions that you're asking. So this is part of the process. This is part of the process of figuring out, you know, what it means to be Hindu American in this day and age. And like I said, because we're the first generation to be raised Hindu American in this country, born and raised in this country, that can be daunting in terms of articulating our identity. It can also be exciting because we can start anew. And the other thing I think is a great opportunity for us in the United States is this notion of South Asian American. So many of my friends identify as South Asian American, and that means that Indians and Pakistanis and Bangladeshis and Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs and, you know, Sri Lankans and North Indians and South Indians, we can all work together under this rubric of a South Asian identity in a way that we can't even do in South Asia.
Right.
And so like when I had my radio show, it was music from South Asia and its diaspora. So I played a lot of music from, you know, everywhere, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, not just India. That to me is exciting. When we started an organization in 2008, South Asians for Obama. It wasn't Indians for Obama.
Right.
It was South Asians for Obama. I love that idea of a South Asian identity in the United States that goes past the divisions that we inherited from our parents and grandparents around caste or region or religion.
That were colonial in construct in the first place.
Yeah. So I really like that. And I think that in a way, the South Asian American identity may get in the, you know, may disallow us from fully engaging in what a Hindu American identity is. But I think that that's a unique American thing, the South Asian identity that allows us to do creative work. And the reality is, as South Asians, we've all had a very similar experience in the United States. It doesn't matter if we're Sikh or
that's
Muslim.
True.
It doesn't matter if I'm Indian or Pakistani. My experience is more similar to, you know, my Sikh friend than it is to, you know, other non-South Asians, even though I didn't grow up wearing a turban or I didn't have the same exact challenges he might have had.
Right.
We still, you know, as South Asians in this country, we've had a very similar experience. So.
Are you wearing a kara? I just noticed.
Yeah, I'm wearing a kara. So I have a lot of, I'm Punjabi, I have a lot of Sikh family.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right.
Well, again, thank you so much. Yes. And you know, best of luck with everything going forward. And we hope we get the chance to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.